This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross, Colleen O'Brien. All of us have been mystified at one time or another by a bill we got from a doctor or a hospital. And that's why Dr. Marty McCarry wrote a book called The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. And first of all, you are a doctor. You're a medical doctor, right?
Yeah.
Oncologist?
Cancer surgeon. Yeah, surgical oncologist.
But what got you interested in wanting to expose the reasons behind medical costs?
Well, people are getting crushed out there right now, Dave, and it's obvious to a lot of us that are taking care of patients. I mean, people are getting crushed with overpriced bills, surprise bills, bills they shouldn't be getting, bills that are marked up way beyond what an insurance company or Medicare would pay. And, you know, most of America does not live like you and me. Most of America has less than $400 of cash on hand, and they are getting hammered right now. And somebody has got to stand up. I mean, the role of a physician historically has been to advocate for those who are vulnerable. Talk to a nurse, talk to a doctor. They will tell you, listen to patients. They're telling us right now, they just want honesty. Right now, many medical centers are charging as much as the market will allow. Yeah. They're using their monopoly power with mass consolidation. They're taking advantage of people with surprise bills. They're having them sign their life away when they walk into the emergency room. You're financially signing your life away just to be treated. I mean, this is not who we are. The reason I'm here is that we're trying to rally people. We're not just talking about a problem that's broken. We're trying to fix it. And you're seeing tremendous movement right now.
What's happening?
There are medical centers that are saying enough is enough. We're going to give you prices. Uh-huh. The insurance companies are giving them hell. Hospitals are giving them hell.
Why is it even possible? they don't have the right to say you can't get into the game, do they?
I can tell you the story of the Surgery Center of Oklahoma. Here's a surgery center that does a whole host of operations. You can go on their website and they'll show you the price of each and every one of them. It's a complete price. It's a comprehensive price. It includes everything. There's a complication, they eat it. People who are paying out of pocket, which is a fast-growing group of Americans because the deductibles now, they're so ridiculously high, people are paying out of pocket. Where are they going to go? Are they going to go to a place that offers an honest, fair, and transparent price regardless of who you are or who your insurance is? Or are you going to go to a place that won't give you a price and you could get gouged?
Yeah. Well, then this innovation should be spreading like wildfire.
Well, it's hard to take this step because the market gives tremendous pressure to these innovators to say, don't be different. You have to be in a network or out of a network. And to be honest, many of these networks are sold to employers on a market that is managed by brokers. That industry is as corrupted as the subprime mortgage broker industry was. They're not giving you the best deal a lot of times. There's a small group of honest brokers with a brand now called the Health Rosetta Brokers. It's actually a movement that started here in Washington State in the Seattle area. There are businesses that are saying, we're going to put out our health insurance out for bid every year. We want to talk to as many of these brokers as possible. We're only going to work with brokers that don't take kickbacks. The vast majority of them are taking kickbacks from the insurance companies. It's a game. When people say, oh, I only had to pay $500, thankfully, my insurance company paid the rest or my employer paid the rest.
Yeah.
No, you paid all of that. That's your premiums. And all the talk about premium relief, that's not real relief when you just jack up the deductibles to $5,000 and $10,000
right.
Or 20% copay. People are getting hammered. And to write this book, The Price We Pay, I traveled to 22 cities around the United States over 2 years and talked to everybody. And I'm convinced it's three things: fixing care coordination, fixing the appropriateness crisis. We have a crisis of appropriateness of too much care.
Oh, and unnecessary tests and unnecessary operations.
Yeah. And then the third issue is pricing failures. The Federal Trade Commission has been asleep at the wheel. Uh-huh. I mean, how do you have all this mass consolidation to the point where patients, you know, have only one option in an entire region of a state for their health care and they have to pay the bill, whatever it is? You know, hospitals will sometimes go after patients and sue them for unpaid medical bills.
Yeah.
It's one of the disturbing trends that my research team at Hopkins has been uncovering. I've been voluntarily offering to be a pro bono expert in their cases. And I tell the judges, look, there's no contract. They don't have to pay the bill. There's no contract. There was no prices disclosed to the patient. They even asked, how much is this going to cost? And so, you know, we don't live in North Korea. You know, this is not the sort of the authoritarian, you know, you receive this care because you broke your arm and now you have to go to the, you know, have to pay this bill, or we're going to put a lien on your home, as we've seen, or garnish your wages, as we've seen. Medical care was never intended to be like this. I mean, I've talked to lawyers. We have a legal theory that hospitals do not have a right to ruin your credit history or to garnish your wages or put a lien on your home over a contract that's invalid. Yeah. First of all, you're vulnerable when you came in there. No prices were disclosed. And you can't ask somebody when they come in clutched over with appendicitis to sign their financial life.
You get
away.
A court ruling on that, that would upset the whole system.
Well, look, I'm a cancer surgeon myself. I'm constantly reminded how short life is. Half of women with stage 4 breast cancer in the United States today are getting actively harassed by medical debt collectors. That is a disgrace.
The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It by Marty McCary, MD. Marty, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Great to be with you, Dave.
Dr. McCary's podcast will be up today on the Ross Files, and I think it's worth sharing with somebody who's wondering if they should contest an arbitrary medical bill, or you could also share it with a politician who doesn't seem to know what to do to fix health care. Just Google Ross Files, and it comes right up.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual variety of natural attraction.
Of course, Felix gets high on scratchy records. Felix Spinella, resident historian, every Friday morning he's here for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And this week we're going to find out why it's called Commencement Bay, Eagle Harbor, and Bud Inlet. Are we doing them in that order?
Oh, I'm not sure yet, because this is really about a guy named Charles Wilkes. He should be as well known as George Vancouver, but he's not. He was born in 1798. He commanded the United States Exploring Expedition, or the USXX for short, which sailed around the world from 1838 to 1842. Wilkes and his crew, they had six vessels. They were here in the Northwest for several months in 1841. This was 5 years before the British and the Americans settled that long-running joint occupation of the Oregon country. And Wilkes' time here can be viewed as a strategic assertion of American influence. For my money, this is the very best kind of big government anyone could ask for in 1841. And we talked about the 4th of July celebration they held here a couple of years ago in 1841, the first one west of the Mississippi or the Missouri River. Anyway, while they were here in Puget Sound, Wilkes and his crew conducted a major hydrographic survey. They mapped the land and measured the depth of the water in harbors and bays and bestowed names on dozens of now familiar places. So in Tacoma, harbor there is called Commencement Bay, and that's where the survey of Puget Sound began, commenced, May 15th, 1841, led by Lieutenant Cadwallader Ringgold and the 88-foot-long brig, the Porpoise. Now, Seattle here, it's called Elliott Bay, and there's some confusion as to who Wilkes named Elliott Bay for. For decades, it was assumed to have been named for the chaplain of the expedition, Reverend J.L. Elliott. But the chaplain and Wilkes had a falling out, and now scholars generally believed it was named for midshipman Samuel Elliott, who actually took part in the survey of Elliott Bay. It had been known as Duwamish Bay for many years before that, and the Elliott Bay name didn't really catch on, but it wasn't the reverend, it was the midshipman. Now, how about Olympia? Do you know the name of the body of water around Olympia?
It's Nisqually something?
Well, Bud Inlet is the one I think it's.
But I thought that's part of the Nisqually Delta.
No. I think that's more the land. Anyway, Bud Inlet was named by Wilkes for Thomas Bud. Bud was the acting master or the navigation specialist of the USS Peacock. Now, the Peacock famously ran aground on the north bank of the Columbia River in July 1841 at a place known ever since as Sully.
What? Peacock Spit.
Peacock Spit, exactly.
Well, now it's Benson Bay because the Benson crashed there, too.
Oh, wow. Anyway, in Bremerton, Sinclair Inlet was named for George T. Sinclair, a member of the crew who went on to fight in the Civil War on the wrong side, the Confederate States. And Bainbridge Island, Eagle Harbor, is named for being shaped like an eagle. I just don't see it, personally. I've looked at it on the chart. The North Cape is called Wing Point, like an eagle, and the South Cape is called Bill Point. I wonder if the bill there doesn't mean beak, but maybe means there were several people named Bill on the expedition who it might have been named for. So that's my addition to the scholarship of local name history.
There you go. Well, good. I thought Bud Inlet was named after a fine beer, but there you go. You can find all of Felix's pieces at MyNorthwest.com. In Washington State, government institutions are banned from using affirmative action, but now there is an initiative to lift that ban in this state, and it takes to the streets today for a march from Seattle to Olympia. Yesterday, people on both sides packed a hearing in Olympia, and Hannah Scott is here with the details.
Dave, so Washington is only one of eight states that has a ban on affirmative action. That, of course, came in 1998 when voters approved I-200. Now we've got I-1000, which got a record number of signatures to qualify for the ballot. It's an initiative to the legislature, and what this would do would roll back I-200, the ban on affirmative action in our state. So it would allow for the state to use hiring and recruitment goals, but not quotas, to bring minority candidates into state jobs, education, and contracting, and loosen restrictions from that ban. This we would consider race, gender, sex, disability, ethnicity, several other classes, but they could not be the sole factor for a less qualified candidate to be chosen, because that would be called preferential treatment, and that would still be banned. In an overflow crowd in Olympia yesterday, there was a joint hearing on this initiative. All three of our living former governors kicked off that hearing with strong support, urging lawmakers to approve this measure. Former Governor Dan Evans told the committee the state had made progress since he created a commission on civil rights 6 months after taking office in 1965.
It was apparent that discrimination was pervasive and deep, even in this relatively enlightened state. We began the task of opening opportunity to all citizens of Washington State. We've made significant progress in the years since, but the door of opportunity is still just ajar.
Governor Christine Gregoire added,
I-1000 opens the door. That's all it does. It opens the door to qualified candidates who want to go to college, who want public employment, and want public contracting.
And former Governor Gary Locke stressed that this was not about restoring the old version of affirmative action.
There's no preferential treatment allowed under Initiative 1000. Quotas are not allowed under Initiative 1000. The hiring and the admission of unqualified or lesser qualified individuals is not allowed under Initiative 1000. But recruitment and outreach is expressly permitted.
And there were dozens of supporters there backing this up.
As long as our society discriminates based on race, we must use race to remedy that discrimination.
I don't come saying we need a handout. What I say is, this is a tool, and that's what state governments need, that's what cities need, that's what businesses need, a tool to look at historical injustices.
Please support I-1000. It's not radical, it's not scary, and we should not be divided by fear. A bigger pie for everyone is great for our economy.
But there was also a huge amount of criticism.
Race has no place in American life or law, and certainly not in Washington.
I-1000 would abolish the standard of equality for all, regardless of race, as required by I-200, and replace it with a system that uses different rules for people of different races.
This racist bill of Initiative 1000 will bring back discrimination to one group of people by giving preference to the other group of people based upon their gender, skin colors, and races.
So arguments on both sides saying this is about fairness and equality. And that's literally the same argument on both sides.
So how does the bill exactly handle this? They're saying it does not give a preference. There's no quota.
Nope, there's a goal.
But there's a goal. Mm-hmm. So what does that look like on the ground?
And I don't know that that's entirely worked out yet. There would be a commission created that would involve the lieutenant governor and the state attorney general. I tried to look up to see what the goals specifically would be, and a number for that. I don't see that anywhere.
If we're going back, I mean, I know something about this because the year I went to college was when the Ivy League first started an affirmative action program.
Right.
And the idea there was they weren't changing the admission standards, but what they were doing was sending out college recruiters into neighborhoods they would never go before, like Harlem.
Right.
Right. They would go to the suburbs and recruit people like me, but they would never go to the inner city where there clearly could be people who were talented enough to go. And so affirmative action said, we're going to specifically target communities of a certain race and income level to find out if there exists there people who are ready for a college education. And that's the form it took. So it wasn't saying you will bring in so many people of this race. It was you will at least reach out to them so they have a chance to come.
This is absolutely about recruitment and outreach, and it would definitely do exactly what you just described. But again, you could not choose a person solely based on whatever one of those factors, race, gender, sexual, all of those.
Right.
a lesser qualified candidate based solely on that. You would have to, that would be considered preferential treatment, and that is still banned under I-1000. A lot of support for this, and I want to point out that the march that's happening today, which, by the way, is being marshaled by Michael Bennett, former Seahawk, it starts off at Rainier Birds High School at 6 this evening. It's a four-day march that ends at the state capitol on Monday.
All right. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Boy, who doesn't love a good singing competition? A contest where people who have almost nothing in common, they're accountants, they're bulldozer operators, they're baristas. The one thing they do have in common is they have incredible voices. And now there's a movie about it.
There is indeed. You know, almost by definition, Dave, singing competition shows are lively, they're energetic, they're upbeat affairs full of musical fireworks, dramatics, highs and lows. Movies like Pitch Perfect and TV dramas like Glee have really capitalized on these naturally fun ingredients, not to mention the actual competition shows like The Voice and American Idol. A relatively low-budget British film called Teen Spirit covers the same rather cliched ground, but it does so with such a melancholy air that it almost seems fresh. And actress Elle Fanning, sister of Dakota, has a decent enough voice to convince us she just might be able to compete in the real thing. Now, Dave, you're talking about people that have nothing in common. Here's somebody who's from outside the mainstream. Fanning plays Violet Valensky, a shy 17-year-old farm girl growing up on the Isle of Wight off the coast of England. Her rather uninspired life consists of taking boring classes at school and waitressing at a drab restaurant. She also has to work the farm in order to help out her sad mom, whose husband and Violet's father has left her. Violet's only escape from the drudgery is singing karaoke at a rundown bar. When a singing competition called Teen Spirit announces it's doing auditions in her hometown, she decides to sneak away and give it a shot.
Your name?
Violet Valensky.
What is that, Russian?
Polish.
Somebody said you got a new friend. Does she love you better than I can?
Now, the judges criticize Violet's lack of polish, but compliment her raw talent and pass her through to that next level of competition. Meanwhile, she attracts the attention of a washed-up Croatian opera singer who becomes her coach-slash-manager-slash-father figure. The rest of the movie charts their journey through the treacherous waters of competition and fame. Now, for a movie about a talent show competition, there's a surprising dearth of songs. Violet gets only 3 songs. That's one for each half hour of the 90-minute movie, and they're all pretty similar. One by Robin, one by Ellie Goulding, and the last one by Siegfried. In fact, one of the judges critiques her for singing a song with such a limited range, and that could go for all 3 of them. And the singing of the other contestants is barely featured at all. Curiously, first-time director Max Minghella, son of Oscar winner Anthony Minghella, seems less interested in the musical performances than he is in the human drama behind the scenes. Unfortunately, the offstage drama is what feels most cliched about the film. Fights with her mom, voice lessons about singing from your heart, fights with her manager, seduction by the record companies. We've seen it all before. Now, it's true, we've seen plenty of music videos as well, but at least musical performances would seem to offer a filmmaker a little more creative freedom, allow him to have a bit of fun, or maybe provide some serious catharsis. Minghella takes a stab at catharsis near the end, but it's pretty muted, much like Violet's own response to the way things work out. And maybe that's the movie's point. A pushy record executive tells Violet at one point,
"You're a caterpillar. We're a cocoon. Maybe together we make a butterfly."
At movie's end, Violet is still a caterpillar, and so is Teen Spirit.
So how does this competition work? Do they have judges, coaches? Do they have saves and steals?
There are no saves and steals. Not that sophisticated, but it is an audience participation. So it's like The Voice. You have to, an American Idol. You call in and you root for it. And so at one point, the record executive says, "Listen, you're raw. You have a difficult name to pronounce. You're Polish. You're from a place nobody has ever been, to." It's like, you've got a heart. You need us to push you. So there are calculations involved.
Okay. The thing that's getting to me about The Voice is that every time they send somebody away, they tell them that they are the greatest singer we've ever heard.
Yes.
You're going far.
Yeah.
But goodbye.
And you never hear of them again either.
I know.
Everyone's the greatest singer you ever heard.
Yes. Well, the thing is, this is all up. It's about uplift, isn't it, Dave? And that's what's interesting about this movie. This movie isn't like all sad or all happy, but it's like it's never very high or very low. It's just kind of like it's more like life.
The comments are better than the Simon Cowell thing. But
okay, there
still,
you go.
After a while, man, I could just press the hotkey and
and eject them
and just hear the same thing again and again. Tom Tangney, how many tangs?
I give it 3 out of 4.
For Teen Spirit. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.
Just a quickie daily dose of kindness today. I thought it was nice because we started the week with those horrific pictures of Notre Dame Cathedral burning. So I wanted to end on a lighter note also involving that famed cathedral. Shortly after the fire, a picture began to circulate on Twitter. It was taken just an hour before the fire. Brooke Windsor took it. It's of a father and daughter, hand in hand, swinging and twirling together in front of Notre Dame. It's a beautiful picture, certainly one that any family would want, a bright spot on a dark day. Brooke wrote on Twitter, "I almost went up to the dad and asked if he wanted. Now I wished I had. Twitter, if you have any magic, help him find this picture." It wasn't until yesterday that the man had been found, though he wished to remain anonymous. And in today's social media world, I can't say I blame him. But she says he was grateful for the scenic shot and planned to treasure it for years to come. She wrote, "Thank you to everyone who has shared this picture and for your kind words on this journey." Time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle Now, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. It's Danny O'Neill, who you can hear weekdays at 3 on Danny, Dave, and Moore. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, Colleen. How are you?
I'm doing good. First of all, I'm good because the Mariners' losing streak is over.
Healy sliding stop, got it. Toss across in time, and the ball game is over. The Mariners win it 11-10 here in Anaheim. Yes, indeed, and one of their wildest wins in a long, long time.
Wild because at one point they were up 10-2.
And then it was 10-10. They gave up. The bullpen was absolutely on fire in a terrible way.
Yeah.
Four relievers gave up a combined total of 7 runs, allowed 7 runs to cross the plate while they were pitching.
I feel like that's a common Mariners storyline, though. Do I remember that from last season or the season before where they'd be up just gobs of points and then they give it up?
Well, certainly the Fernando Rodney experience was excruciating. When you had, you remember him, he launched the imaginary arrows.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah,
oh,
he punctuated them. Yes. And sometimes also it was a not-so-imaginary meltdown that he would have. And it was an excruciating experience. This year's a little more, it's not by design, but we knew that the bullpen was an issue. We knew that the bullpen was held together with scotch tape.
We talked about that yesterday.
And they had traded or moved on from 4 of their top 5 relievers from last year. And that's not the wrong decision for a team that was not specifically gearing up to make the playoffs this year. They got good exchange on those players and built for the future, and bullpens tend to be notoriously fickle. Year in, year out, they can fluctuate, but yeah, that bullpen's going to be an issue over the course of the season.
So are we starting to come back down to reality that this is a rebuild season?
Well, it depends on what you mean by rebuild. That they're probably not going to make the playoffs? Yeah, okay. I think that that's what we're looking at.
Okay,
is a rebuild season of 75 wins? No, I think they're going to finish with a winning record. I think they're a better team than most people expected.
Oh, good.
So I guess this would qualify as our first official dumpster fire that you've been predicting out of the. I mean, because it's hard to give up or send 11 men to the plate with that many relievers. I mean, that was just trash.
You had four different relievers that gave up runs. The only one who pitched effectively was Roenis Elias, who even then had a early single in the ninth inning before shutting the door and getting the save. Yeah, that was the first dumpster fire.
You were at an event last night where Seahawks GM John Schneider gave updates on Frank Clark, Bobby Wagner, and Doug Baldwin.
Which there were no updates,
what?
Really, when you come to it. Frank Clark still has the franchise tag on him. They're hoping to negotiate and get a long-term deal signed with Frank.
I've heard that they've set aside enough to do that.
They certainly have enough money to do it. The question is, does Frank want more than what they're willing to spend? It's not going to be that he's asking for more than they have to spend. It's that the contract he's looking for is more than they're willing to spend now.
Am I remembering correct? He's the one that had the issue with the dog stuff, right? Frank Clark, who was the player who had the issue with the dog stuff and animal? It's not Frank Clark, is it?
No.
It's somebody else.
Frank Clark was arrested in his senior year at Michigan before the Seahawks drafted him
for... That's all well and put in the past and all that.
It has, yeah. Okay. He was never charged in the incident, but yeah.
All right, moving on. So Bobby Wagner, Doug Baldwin.
Bobby Wagner is in line for an extension. It's a little tricky because he's representing himself. And if I was John Schneider, I would not want to negotiate with a player on his own behalf. I think that becomes extremely difficult.
Right.
Because usually the agent's a buffer when you go to them and explain why you're not going to give them the moon. When you have to talk directly to the player, I think that's a little tougher. But I expect that deal to get done. The big uncertainty is Doug Baldwin. Baldwin's undergone three surgeries so far this offseason. His body has certainly shown the wear and tear of the eight NFL seasons that he's played, and they're going to have to wait and see if he bounces back and is able and wants to put his body through that again this season.
Danny, talk about the representing oneself. I know Russell Okung kind of started that. I see a few more players testing that, thinking that, you know, they can do it better because they're the ones that the players. I mean, why is that kind of changing? What is the ground level changing a little bit about representing oneself in the NFL?
Yes, it is. And
why?
We're going to see the reason why is because agents have a business to run. And so there are times they are negotiating a contract. It's on behalf of the player, but they've got an eye toward what that will mean for future clients. And then you have a guy like Russell Okung who would say flat out, he gets 4% of a contract that was pretty much by the numbers when I was drafted. 4% of a contract that I could have sketched, I'm going to make less than the guy that got drafted number 5 overall, and I'm going to make more than the guy that got drafted number 7 overall, and it comes in right. Why does he get 4% of my contract for that?
Mm-hmm.
What does he do to get that? I can have a lawyer look it over and make sure that I'm not getting fleeced or hoodwinked by contractual language, but I can do that number. We'll see. There's some risk there. It's a skill and it's an expertise to represent someone and to get them the best deal. But you are seeing more players do it, and I don't think it's necessarily wrong. Ray Allen did it for a while in the NBA.
And the draft is coming up next week.
Heck yeah, it is.
We're running out of time.
We've got four draft picks. The Seahawks are going to trade down from the first round. They're going to pick up some more picks. Yeah, it should be exciting.
All right, we'll ask you Monday what the Seahawks need to make it a winning season. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Your Sports Insider brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. In 2018, there were about 550 murders in Chicago, which is actually down from previous years. But Chicago has certainly gotten a reputation as being, at least south and west sides, as a pretty dangerous place to live. And I think we tend to write off these neighborhoods as a lost cause. Alex Kotlowitz's book will change your mind. It's called An American Summer. This is his latest book on Chicago. And tell me, first of all, how did you get interested in this?
You know, I've been in Chicago now for 35 years. And so my first exposure to the kind of profound poverty in Chicago and elsewhere was when I was working on my first book almost 30 years ago, There Are No Children Here, mm-hmm. when I was spending time in the projects. But for me, the thing that's been most perplexing and most unsettling is the stubborn persistence of the violence in our city and other cities. This book was an effort both to try to make sense of that and really sort of, I think one of the things we've made the mistake of doing is sort of underestimating the impact of the violence on the spirit of individuals and the spirit of community.
Well, reading this, it sounds like there are entire neighborhoods suffering from collective PTSD. The people you describe in this book have the same symptoms as people who come back from Iraq.
Right. No, there's no question about it. I mean, you see, you know, especially young people who are extraordinarily agitated, have trouble sleeping, they self-medicate, they talk about having flashbacks. I think the big difference, and it's a really notable difference, is that there's nothing post about the post-traumatic stress. In other words, you lose a friend one day, and the next day you're looking over your shoulder to make sure it doesn't happen again.
There's a, I'll just read, this is page 22. This is what first tipped me off this was not going to be your usual book about urban violence. As Khalid lay dying, the friend allegedly whispered, "I love you, but I had to do it." This is a guy who shot his friend for fear that the kid couldn't keep his mouth shut about a murder he witnessed.
Right, right. And this, you know, this is not unusual in the city, that one act of violence leads to another act of violence. You know, Khalid witnessed the murder of someone committed by somebody he knew, and Khalid, who was deeply upset and troubled by it, you know, started talking about it in the neighborhood, and he ended up getting killed as a result. And I think one of the things you see in these communities is this extraordinary level of fear. In fact, in Chicago, for reasons nobody can quite explain, we have an extraordinarily low closure rate. So you've got a pretty good chance of getting away with murder in Chicago. 3 out of 4 people get away with
murder. Get away with it.
Yeah. And so what that does is erodes any sense of trust between the police and the communities that they're...
If part of this is to earn respect, which a lot of it seems to be about, don't you earn respect more just by fighting it out with your fist than by flashing a gun?
It certainly used to be the way. I think it has everything to do with the easy accessibility of, you know, Chicago's got pretty strict gun control laws, but you go over into the outlying parts of the county or into Indiana, and it's extremely easy to get weapons.
That's where they're coming from, then?
Yeah, it is, right. And so the Chicago police, I mean, every year they take off the street between 7,000 and 10,000 illegal weapons. It's just this constant river. I think what you see are these seemingly minor disputes erupt into something more. And this goes back to, I think, to something you alluded to earlier. I mean, the commonality of all the violence in Chicago and in all our cities is they happen in deeply distressed neighborhoods, communities in which there's little sense of opportunity, there's little sense of future. People become bitter, resentful. They don't feel respected anywhere else. And so... And I'm not justifying it, just trying to understand it. But look, these are neighborhoods that have been neglected for many years. I mean, I wrote There Are No Children Here some 30 years ago, and I can tell you that for many of these neighborhoods, not only are they not better off, but in some cases they're worse.
Are you a little crazy to do this? Because you embedded yourself essentially in these neighborhoods, and you are, I think what we would call you now, is a privileged white person,
right.
And you're getting everybody, all these minorities, to trust you with their stories.
Right.
How'd you do that?
Right. You know, for me, it's a two-way street. So you're right, I'm going out in the world and I'm asking people to entrust me with telling their stories. And so it's incumbent on me when I go out there to try to be as direct and forward with people as I can about what I'm doing. And some of these stories are deeply intimate. You know, not only about victims, but there's a story about somebody who ends up killing someone and tries to find a way to forgive himself for what he did. And so it's, you know, spending time with people. I worked on this book for almost 6 years and got to know people, you know, in this.
Well, you're usually going to just do it over the summer, right?
That was the book takes place over the course of one summer, and I kind of naively thought, well, this will be a fairly easy book to report. I'll spend a few months reporting and I can sit down and write. And of course, as I got involved in the lives of these individuals and their stories began to unfurl, I stayed with them. I mean, they revealed so much more. So the book, while it's about this one summer, on each date in the summer, you enter a story and you enter on that date, you go hear some of the backstory, and sometimes you move forward in time and then come back. It's like going into this portal.
Well, it's an extraordinary book, yeah. And I think it will change people's perspective on a story that you assume you know the answers until you actually meet these people and realize that for, you know, every one of these 550 murders, there are 550 unique stories.
Right. And my hope is that people get to know the people in this book, that they come to sort of find some empathy, find some common ground.
It's called An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago by Alex Kotlowitz. Alex, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
And you can hear the whole conversation on the Ross Files podcast. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. You can also get it if you download the Cairo Radio app.